Hello, welcome to Carry the One Radio. My name is Katie Cabral, and I'm here with another entry in our Young Scientist Spotlight series. In this series, we interview grad students, postdocs, and other young scientists to learn about their research, hear their stories, and listen to their ideas for how we can fix issues that are facing the scientific community. For this episode, I spoke to Maria Servetnik, who is a master's student in psychology at the University of Leuven in Belgium. Maria studies visual processing, the science of how our brains interpret what our eyes are seeing.
This is Carry the One.
Carry the One Radio, the science podcast.
Igniting scientific curiosity.
From the University of California,
San Francisco.
My kind of life story is that I was very much a humanities girl in high school. And I started, when I started the university, my major was journalism. And I worked as a journalist, and I did 3 years of journalism. And as soon as I started working as a journalist, I realized that I don't actually enjoy it as much. Because I am a person who very much enjoys nerding out about something. I like spending a lot of time figuring out all the tiny details. And when you have like 2 weeks to write a long, complex article, that's not something that you realistically can do. And so I was like, don't like that. And then I very much accidentally stumbled upon an online course on psychology of morality from Yale University on Coursera. Hmm. And I was like, wow, apparently psychology is a science. Because I honestly never knew. I was sure it was like, you know, Freud and like dick jokes and that's it.
And then thought about it as like, oh, this is a real field.
Yes. Completely. Know, that important. Never even crossed my mind that that's something you can actually study as a as a quantitative scientist. And so I quit my university, or I had to restart again from the first year. I went in with already a very strong understanding that I want to be a scientist, and like that's why I'm here. And that's the main slash only reason why I'm here, and that I think shaped my experience a lot. And I actually started doing visual stuff, not because I was necessarily interested in it at the moment, but because I got a piece of advice from my friend who said that it's better to choose an advisor than a topic when you're still starting out. Because as soon as you start kind of getting better at something, and as soon as you learn more about it, you will automatically most likely become interested in it, because it's always nice to do something that you're good at, and so it's always hard to do something at first. And so I was choosing an advisor. I joined the lab of Professor Utechkin, and he is an amazing scientist who does visual research of different kinds, and we did visual long-term memory research together. I loved it. Worked at his lab. Still miss the lab very much.
So you think his mentorship was what really helped you get, like, you know, build you as a scientist and get you into visual processing?
Oh, definitely. He treats bachelor students as actual baby scientists. And so he was like, yeah, you should apply to this international conference that's the biggest in the field. And I was like, is that allowed? Is that a thing I can do? Yeah. So I kind of, yeah, he made me feel like a real scientist and not just a struggling psychology student, because it was hard at first. Yeah, so he definitely shaped my trajectory in a lot of ways.
Now, as a master's student, as you get better as a scientist, do you find yourself wanting to mentor undergraduates to sort of pass that on, or you're not at that stage yet?
So I organized summer schools back in Russia. I used to organize a summer school for like young cognitive scientists who are not from Moscow or St. Petersburg, so who don't really have access to cognitive science education at university where they are from. And so I definitely enjoyed that a lot. And I also organize a data analysis summer school where we also... I think the most important thing we do is we try to make data analysis with R more approachable and fun for students who might have like a harder time learning programming because they don't come from a very technical background. And I don't know, I feel very lucky in the sense that the more I do in academia and the more I see what everyday scientific job or work is like, the more I understand that I actually enjoy most parts of it. So I very much enjoy teaching and miss it a lot because I used to do it more when I was in Russia. And I enjoy helping other people as much as I can because I think the path is very much not transparent. Like, you come, and even if you kind of think that you want to do science, you have no idea, or at least I had no idea how to approach it. And I'm somewhat lucky in the sense that I had a very strong support system, and I am also someone who is not afraid to speak with other people. So I would just annoy all the professors with my, like, beginner ideas of whatever research I thought was exciting. But, like, that's not necessarily a choice one can make, right? Or not a choice one can make in the moment.
Yeah.
So I enjoy it, and I think it's very, very important to make the academic career or research in general more accessible, and more accessible to people who maybe don't know who to ask or are afraid to do so, and who feel like they might be interested in it but don't know how to approach it. So I'm trying to do that, be like a friendly beacon of whatever research.
So, speaking of research, can you give us a general idea of what you study?
So, the basic idea is that the world around us that we see, is full of kind of repetitive information. Think, I don't know, a bunch of trees, mm-hmm. leaves on one tree, group of people. And so the visual system uses this repetitive information, and it's able to extract kind of summary statistics about groups of objects in a laboratory setting. That means that participants are generally good at reporting, say, the average orientation of a bunch of oriented lines or average size of a bunch of circles of different sizes. And in real world, that means that we're actually kind of good at, detecting or extracting the average motion of a bunch of people. If we see like a crowd, you can kind of estimate where they're all going and stuff like that. And we can even seemingly extract what's called like higher order features. So orientation and color and stuff, those are kind of simple or basic for the visual system. But there's also research about us being able to extract the average emotion of a group of faces, an ensemble of faces, or even average gender and stuff like that. And so those groups of objects are called ensembles, and the summary statistics that our visual system extracts are called ensemble statistics. And so that's what I currently study.
Okay, so, like, I was on a vacation a couple weeks ago, I was in the mountains, there's lots of mountains, lots of rocks, lots of trees, and my visual system is just processing all that once and be like, wow, this is beautiful, there's gray and green, and I'm not thinking about each individual point in my
vision. Yeah, kind of. It's thought of as kind of a mechanism that makes visual processing more efficient, where instead of like processing every stone, every tree, every person at once and being like, okay, so this one's small and this one's big, so on average they're like average, it does the summary thing. So you don't actually need to kind of render every stone. You can render the whole big thing and be maybe less specific about each member. You very often, research shows that you don't actually perceive individual members of the group as well, or you don't remember them as well, but you are surprisingly good at detecting these like averages tendencies. And so that means that the visual system makes use of the repetitiveness of the world to, yeah, maybe be more computationally effective, which is, yeah, an explanation that is proposed often.
And so your hypothesis is that you're doing this without awareness, that this is like a background process that's happening?
Not necessarily. So the thing about awareness in when it comes to visual perception is that it's probably not what you normally think of when I say awareness. So we kind of know that we can process ensembles without paying attention to them. But we can also manipulate awareness in the sense of we can present stimuli in the lab in such a way that the participants don't see the stimuli, but they still have some effect on them. So stuff like priming, for example, where I show you an image for such a short time and, for example, with a mask. So like with noise before and after, which is what I'm doing in my current experiment. And so you are not able to detect whether you have seen a stimulus or you haven't better than chance. So you're basically guessing. But the stimulus that is invisible to you, like consciously, can still have a certain influence on your further processing.
Okay, so it's not just that the subjects aren't paying attention to the ensembles, but that the ensembles are displayed so quickly that the brain doesn't even realize it's seen anything?
Yeah, we know that ensembles can be processed without attention. We don't know if ensemble statistics necessarily can be processed without awareness, which would make sense, because if we can process ensemble statistics without processing individual members, then that points towards that object... that points towards that process being more kind of automatic and quicker than individual perception. So it's possible that while we are unable to process invisible individual objects, we are still able to extract those summary statistics. So that's what I'm trying to check.
These experiments are done with humans, right?
Yeah.
Okay, let's pretend that I'm a participant. So you show me static, and then very quickly, so quickly, I'm not sure if I actually saw anything, you flash something else, these ensembles, and then you show me static again, and then what, you ask me questions about it?
So the experiment that I'm doing currently, it's exactly like that. So you see static, then you very quickly see a bunch of grating stimuli. They are like black and white circles. And so the lines inside the circle can have a certain orientation. And so I show you like an ensemble, a bunch of those oriented circles, and the orientations of each member of the ensemble come from the same distribution. So they're all kind of similar. and then, I show you noise, a bunch of grating stimuli, then noise again. And then I ask you something, I show you one grating stimulus and I ask whether it's tilted to the right or to the left. And so that stimulus can be either have a random orientation, it can have an orientation of one of the members of the ensemble, or the mean orientation of the ensemble. And so that's where I would see the effect of priming, that if you are processing these ensemble statistics without awareness, then there's going to be a priming effect on reaction time. You're going to be answering quicker when it's the mean orientation, because you are being primed by that ensemble. And so that's what I'm checking. I also have a bunch of, or two control tasks, and I have trials with aware and unaware presentation. They're timed differently, so we can compare them. Yeah, it's a lot of piloting, and it's a lot of trying to find the exact noise and the exact timing that works. That's what I'm doing right now.
So a lot of optimization before you can get like, all right, this is the final experiment I'm going to do, and then I'll just collect all the data and publish my thesis.
Exactly, yes. Yes, that's basically my whole summer, I would say. And the whole kind of idea of priming ensemble statistics hasn't really been done before, as far as I know. So we had to check that it works with awareness first, and according to the pilot it does, which yay meant that I was able to continue. So now it's, yeah, another stage of more and more piloting. But yeah, I'm enjoying it because I think in a way it's a new thing for me. That's what I'm kind of learning from my advisor this year, is to pilot a lot, pilot on every step. And yeah, turns out I make a lot more mistakes than I used to think I do. I did. So good to know.
But you're learning from them more quickly. You set it up to like fail quickly and then finds, you know, what is working.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think what I used to do, because I, in Russia, or at least at my university, you have like a thesis every year, except for the first year. So I did an experiment in my second, third and fourth year. And what I used to do is I would have this big idea of an experiment, and then I would like code it all together, and then I would collect all the data, and then I would deal with that. And that meant that if I made a mistake somewhere along the way, I would find out about that very, very late. And so I would have to redo a lot of stuff, and I would, yeah, spend a lot of resources on doing that, even though it could have been... it could have been avoided. So yeah, I'm realizing why piloting is the boss.
What is your next goals in terms of career? So you're doing your master's right now. Do you plan on pursuing your PhD? Do you know what you want to do, you know, 20 years from now?
It's a loaded question. I want to do a PhD 100%. And my ideal 20-year plan is that I have my own lab. I want that. But also... because the academic job market is specific, especially in the times of Corona, I have like three backup plans. Being a researcher is my dream. Like, that's what I enjoy doing it. It gives my life purpose in a lot of ways. And I'm going to give it my all to do that and to kind of achieve that. So I'm going to do a PhD, I'm going to do a postdoc if I find a postdoc, I'm going to do a second postdoc if I find a second, like, so I'm going to go as far as I can go, yes.
If you could change the system, you know, science or the way that we train and hire scientists, you know, we promote people to professors, like, what would you change?
Oh, that's a good question. I think we don't have enough... separation of job responsibilities, and I think we don't have enough organizational and managerial training for professors and PIs especially, because one of the like better organized labs I know, the PI worked in the industry for like 15 years and then he came back with the industry knowledge, and his lab is like running like a clock or whatever, however you say that. Perfect. So I think that's something that academia kind of lacks. And that also influences the work-life balance issues and the burnout and the everything that comes with that. On one hand, I feel like starting... but trying to do science as early as possible and finding out if you actually like the day-to-day activities of it is very important. But also it's important to be able to, you know, not put yourself in a little box early on. Because I definitely feel like, for example, I did not study math at all in high school. I was like, I'm literature, I don't need that. And you know what? I do need that. I need that 10 years from that point. And I'm very sad that I had this idea that I can just choose my specialization when I'm 15 and it's going to work for my whole life, you know? So it's kind of it has to be a balance between being able to specialize in something early on, but not lock yourself inside that specialization, kind of. So it might be something like, you know, early on lab rotations for students who are interested in that. I actually feel like my faculty back in Moscow was very good at that. And my faculty here at K11, like my program, is very good at that as well. Because there's a lot of... we have a big internship in the master program. and you're also supposed to choose topics from different fields or subfields of psychology while you're studying, so you get to try and kind of touch with your paw different things and see what you like and what you don't like.
So more opportunities early on to see, is this right for you? And if not, maybe you should move on to the next thing that would make you more excited.
Yeah, definitely. Because I think there's this idea that life has like a very direct linear trajectory, and it doesn't.
Yeah.
Or at least mine doesn't, and I don't think most people's either. So the earlier you get rid of this idea, oh, I'm going to do good at school, and then I'm going to do good at university, and I'm going to find a good job, and that's it. And then I'm like sitting on my, you know, chair of success or something. That it's not how life works, and that's not the goal. We shouldn't strive to achieve exactly that. You know, it's all we're all wandering through life. It's okay.
Yeah, and like you don't want to go like you can't like just like go like straight to your success and not experience life in the meantime. That might change your opinions or change your priorities. Yeah, it's definitely a balance.
Oh, definitely. Oh yeah, it was switching my major was a very interesting experience for me in that regard, because I never really tried studying. Like, I was always just generally good at whatever I was supposed to do,
mm-hmm.
or good at avoiding things that I didn't deem important enough. Math. So I kind of sailed through life up until my psychology education started, because I was just doing the things I'm generally good at. And then I came to study psychology, and I was three years older than everyone. I was already married by that point. I got married early. I had job experience, so I felt like a perfect adult. I was 19, but I felt very adult and old and wise, surrounded by 16-year-olds. And all those 16-year-olds were smarter than me, because they had just passed their biology exams, their math exams. I knew nothing about biology and math. I remember coming to my first lecture, and it was a neuroanatomy lecture. And the professor, it wasn't the first lecture of the course, because I came in later on. And so I come to this lecture, it's my first lecture, and I sit there and I listen to the lecture, and I understand that I understand some of the words separately, but I definitely do not understand all of the words. And I do not understand the sentences. And I remember like texting my best friend in panic and being like, oh my God, she's talking about like brain bubbles. Why are there bubbles in the brain? You know? Yeah. So that was a nice kind of wake up call or cold shower. And I realized that, yeah, I actually need to learn how to study and how to be dedicated and be intentional in my development. And I feel like that moment comes for everyone, or almost everyone. Like, at one point you're just, if you know how to sail through life, at one point you exhaust your like sailing ability, and you're faced with the fact that you actually have to try hard now. And I feel like it's much scarier to face that when you're 40 than when you're 19, you know?
Yeah.
Like, imagine already being an accomplished person with a completely built identity, formed identity, you know? And you're like, oh, wait. I actually am not as good as I thought I was. So I'm kind of glad that I had that experience at 19.
Yeah, I mean, 19 is a good time to, like, be totally overwhelmed and have to grow a bunch as a person. Like, that's a good time for it. That's what college is for.
Yeah. Exactly. So I'm glad that I switched majors, even though literally everyone thought it was a bad idea.
Do they still think it's a bad idea? You've got your degree, you're on your master's now.
Yeah, no, I think they're happy now. Or at least, yeah. I still have people who don't think that research is a useful thing, but that's just something that's very hard to have a discussion about when it's such a big discrepancy in views. So, you know, I do my thing.
So I think it can be hard as a scientist just to, like, talk to family and friends who aren't scientists just about, like, you know, what do I do and why does it matter? But I think it's even harder if you have people who don't trust, you know, science or research as a whole.
Yeah.
And here in the U.S., that's a big problem right now, especially particularly with the pandemic or climate change.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like a lot of the times it's it has to do with general distrust in power structures. And so it's kind of an overkill or overshoot of critical thinking.
Mm.
And, you know, it's kind of the way... Yeah, I don't know. I honestly have not found a good way to deal with that because I think my examples are pretty mild. Thankfully. I don't know how to talk to people who... I guess don't believe in science, but also believing is a weird choice of word.
Yeah, that's it's tough to be like, yeah. You know, I believe in science, but like, do I believe in science or just like, do I trust in the scientific process and that, you know, science and scientists will find the answers eventually, even if like the first answer might not be right and then more data will, you know, prove or disprove or, you know, those conclusions.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, because I feel like there's also kind of another side to that or a separate problem where people use scientific research as a simple way to get an answer.
Mm.
Like, oh yeah, this is like that because this one paper says so. Like, no, that's not necessarily how science works, you know? It's a combination of different sources and different viewpoints even and different theoretical frameworks, and I don't know, I feel like a lot of times we expect science to give us simple answers, but true science, or at least what I think is good science, is nuanced. It's always you have to think of the world complexly because it is complex. And that's obviously hard to, you know, communicate with people, communicate to people and stuff like that. And that's also one thing I was thinking about recently, is that I have this kind of distrust towards scientific journalists. But I need to think about it as a collaboration, you know? It has to be a mutual interest, because I do want people to understand like the research I'm doing and the research other people are doing, and I obviously can't, like, that's a full-time job, right? That's not something I can realistically do full-time myself because I have research.
Yeah.
So I need to think of scientific communicators as people from, you know, from my camp.
I think it's them. Hard because there are so many science communicators that I respect, but then, you know, one big science story will come out and there'll be a lot of great nuanced takes, but then also some really dumb headline that doesn't actually get at the gist of it, and people just tweet based on what they say the headline is, and the headline is poorly written, and not actual science is being communicated there, because people want not just like the easy answer, but like what's the like 10-word answer that just says like yes or no, X is good or bad. So it's so hard when everything is much more complicated than like a headline.
The thing is that most of the time it's not a malicious thing.
Yeah.
Like mainstream media, whatever that means, these days, when they, you know, misrepresent a study, most of the time it's not an intentional thing. It's maybe a lack of understanding or lack of time or something like that. So I can either be mad at it and be like, ooh, dumb journalists, whatever. Or I can, if I have the resources and so on, try and maybe reach out, or maybe not necessarily to this one journalist that, you know, wrote an incorrect article, but I have friends who are interested in science communication, and I can let them know that I'm up to explaining stuff.
So we talked a little bit about science not being communicated that well to the public. Are there any particular myths or misconceptions about your research that you think the public has that just are not true?
Not about my specific research, because I don't think most people know it exists. But everyone thinks that psychology is something that people study if they want to become like consultants or therapists. So I have to explain all the time that I'm not studying personality or relationships, and I know nothing about your personal problems, and I cannot explain why your mom is acting the way she is. Sorry. I was supposed to go to a conference in Florida this year, and I went to the US Embassy in Brussels to apply, and I had to explain why a psychology major or a psychology master's student is going to a vision science conference. And I had to explain that, yeah, actually psychology also studies vision, because cognitive psychology exists. And so that was a whole thing. Yeah, because psychology is very diverse and has a lot of different approaches within it, as many sciences do, I'm sure. Yeah, so I'd like people to know that.
What do you dislike most about your research or being a scientist? Then I'll ask what you like most. But what's your least favorite thing about doing your research or about being a scientist? Mm. Like what gets you down?
I don't necessarily enjoy communication with participants. Like, you know, a lot of people go into psychology because they like people. And like, I like people. But when you do an experiment and you have like 6 participants at a time, and you have to debrief each and every one of them after the experiment, and you repeat the same thing over and over again, that gets annoying very quickly. And yeah, that's probably not my favorite part. Even though I kind of like collecting data because it's exciting.
What do you like most about your research or about being a scientist in general?
I like that I can get very detailed. Like, the whole purpose of doing research for me is being as specific, as detailed, as exact in what I do as I can be. And that's just very enjoyable to me, first of all. And also it's exciting. It's exciting that I get to do that. And it's exciting that I also get to put on a lot of different hats. Like, for example, when I started doing cognitive psychology, I discovered that I actually very much enjoy coding. And that's a big part of my everyday activities, because I have to code to make the experiments because they're on the computer. And I have to code to analyze data. And I love that so much. But I also get to, you know, interact with the literature in a meaningful way. And I also get to write, which I also like. And that's cool, you know. Yeah, so I don't know, I feel so lucky that it's that I get to do that, even though obviously there are, you know, hard days, and sometimes the conditions are not as good as I would like them to be, and I don't have as much time to be thoughtful about my research as I'd like, but still, I don't know, I can't imagine anything being more exciting than that.
That's great. I think that's all of my questions, but is there anything else you want to talk about?
Oh, I do. My first year of grad school this year was very hard, very challenging, very like filled with self-doubt and stuff like that. And I somewhat randomly did a thing that I think made my life much more enjoyable, and I think is making me a better researcher. And I did it because I heard this phrase, diversify your identity. So I used to very much have one thing that was like my thing. I do science and that's it. Cognitive, yeah, thank you. Like, I would have a hard time talking at parties about things that interest me besides that. I sound like a giant nerd. Mm-hmm. I'm not. I swear. I mean, I am, but in a good way. I can talk to people. And so what I did this year is I got a bunch of hobbies. And I got a bunch of hobbies that I'm bad at. Like, I got very much into cooking. And I even made my own pasta, like, from scratch recently. It was very exciting. Ooh. It wasn't, like, amazing pasta, but the process was very cool. And also I got into like houseplants, and that's nice, and they die sometimes, but that's okay because it's just a hobby, so there's much less pressure. Yeah. You know, and I'm, first of all, it gives me space to be bad at things in a way, like there's not a lot at stake, so I enjoy that. And also it means that even if academia doesn't work out, or even if this day, like, I'm not the best scientist I can be, and if my experiment isn't working or writing isn't going so smoothly, that doesn't mean that I am a failure as a person, you know, because I still have other things about me. I have pasta, and I have my Monstera plant that's thriving, and I have embroidery and whatever else. I'm more than just my research, which also means that because I'm less emotionally connected to my kind of success as a researcher, that means that I am less anxious, I'm less stressed, and that means that it's actually easier for me to just do the thing instead of obsessing over it over and over again, you know? And yeah, that has been a giant improvement in my life this year.
I think it's a good tip. I started knitting during my PhD, and one thing I like about knitting, so it's slow, and you can like watch Netflix while you do it, but unlike my research, like, I can see literal progress. Like, if I knit for an hour of a scarf, like, I have this much scarf done, instead of like, oh, I could spend all day on an experiment and it failed, and I'm like, well, I don't know what I really...
Results.
It's harder to see that progress, even though I did make progress, but it's harder to see it. It was nice to have, like, a visual progress that got made that day.
Definitely. Yeah, that's why baking is working out great for me.
So, just to sum up, I spoke with Maria, a master's student at the University of Leuven in Belgium, about her research on visual processing and whether your brain can process the average features of a group of objects, even if you're being shown the object so fast that it's practically invisible to you. And as someone who only works with cells in a dish, it's really interesting to me to hear from people who work with human subjects. What's also really interesting was her transition from journalism to science. Her journey really highlights the importance of mentorship, outreach, and being open to explore different careers or research topics. We discussed the fact that science is more nuanced than most people perceive, which emphasized the importance of science communication and literacy. Those things are critical in 2020. We are living in challenging times, and it's important to take the time for yourself to make some pasta or bake a cookie. Thanks for listening to The Spotlight. We've got many more episodes coming your way in the next few months. This episode was produced by me, Katie Cabral, with editing help from the rest of the team at Carry the One Radio. I'd like to thank Maria for taking the time to speak with me across many time zones. I'd also like to thank our science producers, Carly Van Orsdell, Janine Cuevas, David Cabral, Samantha Inconel Esselman, and Sama Ahmed for supporting us financially through our Patreon. If you like this episode, you too can support the podcast over at patreon.com/carrytheone. Alternatively, you could tell your loved ones all about us by discussing your favorite CTOR episodes over Zoom Thanksgiving. Or you could leave us a review. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, or email us at carrytheoneradio@gmail.com if you'd like to get in touch with us. I hope you have a happy and safe Thanksgiving, and don't forget, stay curious.